Okay, so we are on page 82. Okay, talking about the difference between Dharma teachers and secular teachers. Yeah, because this will really influence our expectations when we, go into a monastery or a temple, our expectations of the teacher. In addition, Dharma teachers traditionally do not charge for teachings, and students do not pay their teachers. You know, in a secular sense, the teachers are hired by the school or the university, and they get paid, and they negotiate their pay, and the students pay tuition, and so there's that kind of exchange. And people can advocate for how much money they get, and so on. Okay. But here, in a Dharma sense, although in some places that they're now starting to have wages for Dharma teachers, traditionally the teachers don't charge and the students don't pay. Okay. But rather dana or generosity. Donations are given because clearly the teachers need to eat. They need, to go to doctors. They need different stuff, and the students support them. Okay, so the students support the teachers by making offerings and volunteering their services. Here the motivation is one of gratitude, and the offering is given to create merit. It is not payment due, as in a business relationship. So at the Abbey, we decided, we don't charge for anything. All the teachings are free. We had to institute a thing where people gave a donna deposit to keep their place because people were just not showing up or canceling at the last minute, and then other people couldn't come. Okay, but the books, everything, we want to live a life of generosity, so we give, and then we hope that people appreciate what we do and that they support us so that we can do this. So in that way, everybody, it's called an economy of generosity, and everybody creates merit because we get to give. And the people who support us get to give, and everybody's giving because they want to, and because they want the other person to benefit. So it's not a business thing like in a traditional school. Yeah. And so that really makes a difference because in a secular school, since the students are paying, if the teachers aren't teaching properly, then the students are kind of like consumers, and so then they can complain, this teacher, is too tough, this teacher's too easy, the tuition's too high, we don't want to pay that much, we're not getting our money's worth, okay? So there's a whole, the people who come to learn see themselves in many ways as consumers, yeah? If we come to a Dharma center like that, then we really have the wrong attitude. Okay, it's got to be an attitude of seeking to learn and expressing gratitude for what we receive. We're not consumers saying, "Well, look, I paid this amount, so you should," Kind of, you're only teaching for for an hour and a half, and I paid so much, you should teach for 2 hours. This kind of mentality is completely outside a spiritual mentor-disciple relationship. We aren't consumers, okay, with demanding our rights and, negotiating how much we pay. That's just, it's crazy. Okay. As part of their spiritual development, Dharma students are taught to appreciate and respect their teachers. This helps to reduce the students' arrogance and increases their receptivity to learning the Dharma. There is a natural hierarchy in the spiritual mentor-disciple relationship that is useful for subduing students' self-centered attitude. Students do not seek equal status with their teachers. Okay, so, you know, we're the land of equality, supposedly, and, you know, demanding our rights and so on. And so I read in some Buddhist magazines, you know, about somebody wrote a book, was it? What was it called? Something like, you know, showing your teacher how to teach you or something, you know. Anybody remember? It was written by the Sakyong. Anybody remember the title? It was one of those titles. I went, what? You know, it isn't like, okay, I'm going to compete with my teacher and take over their job, kind of like at a university, you know, well, my professor's going to retire and I'll just, you know, kind of take over and get the pay and the whole thing. So this kind of attitude is really beyond the beyond. Some people in the West really complain, oh, there's so much hierarchy in Buddhism. Yeah? And we want equality. There's so much hierarchy. So I think, you know, we need to really think about this because people will say, oh, well, there's hierarchy. You know, the teachers go in first and they sometimes get higher seats and they eat better food and, you know, we want equal rights. You know, and there's a hierarchy with monks and nuns, so the whole Sangha is hierarchy. I did it again. The whole Sangha is, boom, hierarchical. You know, and we want equality and we want to be equal with our teachers. We don't want to have to serve them, you know. And if, you know, if we think like that, then we really, we're not going to benefit very much from relating to a teacher if we have that kind of attitude, okay? Because to really, you know, we'll get on into it a little later, but how to make ourselves a good disciple and somebody who is receptive, you know, if we're arrogant and demanding equality and we want to compete with our teacher and take over their place, that's not a very receptive mind state, is it? You know, that's a mind state of, you know, I want to glorify myself. And that mind state creates a problem in our practice, okay? And so I hear sometimes people talk about this, and I go, you know, I don't want to be equal to my teacher because I'm not equal to my teacher. If I were equal to my teacher, then there's no use in their being my teacher. You know, why do I choose somebody to be my teacher? Because they clearly are more advanced and more knowledgeable and more realized and more compassionate and wiser than I am. If they, you know, if I was equal to them in all those attributes, then there's nothing I can learn. Okay, so I don't want to be equal with my teachers, and I'm not equal with my teachers. So I think, you know, in America, this whole thing, how we get sometimes with equality, we get to be a little bit too much, yeah? And when people complain, oh, there's a hierarchy with the monastics, you know, monastics are seen superior, and, you know, they get to sit in the front row, and we have to sit in the back row, and, you know, it's not fair. You know, I think as monastics, what we train and what one of my teachers really insisted, he said our mantra should be, I am the servant of others. Okay, so as monastics, we shouldn't be seeing ourselves as, well, I'm better than the lay people, you know. So get out of the front row because this is my seat. You know, again, if you're monastic and you have that idea, you're not practicing properly. Okay, but if you're a lay person and you say, well, you know, I'm just good as those monastics, you know, and you're not realizing that the monastics are keeping hundreds of precepts and you're keeping five at the most, and sometimes you don't even keep those, you know, you take fewer than five or whatever, you know, and just, you know, you know, lay people can progress on the path just like monastics can attain realizations and so on. But there's a difference in the kind of practice. And I find in the West that people don't understand the difference in that. In Asia, people do. You know, in Asia, the lay people will go, you know, I can't practice like you practice. You know, I want to have a family. And I want to have a job, and I want to make money and have a more comfortable life. And they say, I really admire that you can give those things up. Yeah. When you, in the West, people go, oh, well, you're celibate. You're just, you know, afraid of intimacy and suppressing your sexuality. Something must be wrong with you, you know. And family life is just as good of a learning opportunity, you know, as monastic life. And then, of course, people come to us later with all of their family problems. So, you know, it's just how you're treated in the West and in the East as a monastic. There's a big difference. And I think in the West, you know, we need to mature in that direction. Yeah. Okay, but like I said, monastics should not at all be arrogant. If they are, they're not practicing properly. Okay, but lay people also shouldn't be arrogant, because if they are, they're not practicing properly. So the whole thing about Buddhism is we cherish other living beings. Okay, and so that should be the foremost thing in our mind, whether we're monastic or whether we're lay, is to cherish other living beings, not to compare ourselves to them and look at social status and so on. Because social status is not indicative of spiritual realizations. And at the time of death, our social status is totally irrelevant and has, you know, no purpose, no meaning, no benefit at all. Okay? So when we die, what's really important is the merit we've created, the dharma that we've assimilated into our life and integrated. You know, that's what's important. You know, what kind of attitudes do we have? What kind of actions did we do? You know, that's going to determine the kind of rebirth we get, not the amount of wealth we have, not our social status. Okay, so all of us need to remember that quite strongly in our practice. Okay, in traditional monastic settings, teachers and students may live in the same building, with students caring for some of their teachers' personal needs, such as preparing meals, cleaning, making appointments, running errands, and organizing events. And lots of other stuff, too. Okay. And entering a... And the reason for this, okay, the student, when you get to offer service like that to your teacher, you benefit because then you get to see how somebody makes decisions, how somebody acts in different situations. You kind of get a close-up view to it, yeah? So you benefit by offering service. You also create a lot of merit, you know? So as students to our teachers, that's what we want to do. And also because the teacher, you know, at least if you're in the Mahayana tradition, wants to benefit as many sentient beings as possible. And to do that, you need people who can help. Yeah. I told you, I think it was yesterday, about the temple I visited in Penang, Malaysia, where they had the old folks' home and then the kindergarten. And I was there and I thought, wow, I would really like to do something like that, you know? That would be so beneficial. And, you know, for the kids, for the old people. But the thing is, you know, when you're one person, you can't do that. Yeah? So, you know, disciples are the ones that help enact the teacher's ideas on how to benefit sentient beings. So I look at my teachers, you know, they all have different projects. And then all of us work in their projects, you know, to help benefit. Because, you know, the teachers will have many ideas about how to benefit. But they can't do everything themselves. Yeah. And so this is, you know, how the disciples step up. If you're familiar with the Suchi Foundation in Taiwan, it began with one nun. And she was at a clinic one day in Taiwan, and one woman came in. She was bleeding. They turned her away because she was poor. And this nun, Venerable Cheng Yen, I get all the Chinese names mixed up. I don't do very well on English names either. Venerable Cheng Yen, you know, she made a determination then to start a hospital. Okay. And so she had a few disciples at that time. And so it was the disciples who, you know, helped raise the money, and she did too. I mean, she had to be involved very clearly. And they built this hospital, and then they wanted to help more and more people. And now Suchi is an international organization all over the world. And when there's natural disasters, they send their volunteers out to help different people. Okay? And so, you know, it all started with the teacher's idea, but she couldn't make it happen on her own. Yeah, it was the effort of everybody together that made that happen. In entering a relationship with a spiritual mentor, having appropriate expectations is important. Although we may have emotional needs, the role of Dharma teachers is not to fulfill these. Okay. This one can be very sticky because we often do not realize that we have emotional needs. And, you know, we meet a spiritual teacher and they're so kind and they're so wonderful. And then, you know, it's like all our longing for love and recognition and appreciation, it all comes up. I want this person to love me and, you know, fulfill all the needs that my parents never did and be this and that and the other thing. And, you know, I want my teacher to listen to my whole story and empathize with my story and, you know, kind of not feel sorry for me, but maybe really empathize and have compassion for me and make things better. And, you know, I can go to them anytime with all my problems and I can just go and put it all out there and cry as I need to. And, you know, and so, you know, when you find a compassionate person, that's how we react, yeah. But that's not exactly the role in the job description of a spiritual mentor. Yeah, the spiritual mentor is to lead us to awakening. Yeah, they're to educate us spiritually, train us spiritually. Yeah, they're not there to meet all of our emotional needs. Because no one externally can meet all of our emotional needs. Something we have to be very clear about. No other external person can meet all of our emotional needs. The only person who can deal with our emotional needs is ourself. You know? And the whole world can praise us, but if we don't like ourselves, our self-esteem remains low. Yeah? The Buddha could come here and tell us we were the most wonderful people in the world, but we won't believe in ourselves if we don't believe in ourselves. Okay? So all this kind of stuff we have to grow it in our own mind. Nobody can give it to us. Yeah? And if we come into the relationship with the spiritual mentor, expecting that, I can tell you from experience, it becomes painful, okay? Because your teacher's there to serve, your teacher has many disciples. They're there for all sentient beings. So I remember going and, I have some problem and I want to see my teacher and I really need to see my teacher because I'm really upset about something. And the attendant says, sorry, there's a lot of people in front of you and the teacher also has to eat and do some other stuff. And, but this is my teacher and I have this problem and he should be able to listen to me. And you have to handle it yourself. Yeah, I could give you some examples when this came up for me, but maybe I won't. we really have to have a correct idea. I remember thinking that... because in the West, what we like to do is tell everybody our story, don't we? Yeah? Everybody here have a story? Your story and your childhood and what happened in your childhood and your parents and what they did to you or what they didn't do to you and all the things you tried. And, we have our whole story. And we love telling it to people. In fact, that's how we get to know people. It's by telling them our story and listening to their story. So I thought that my teacher's going to, of course, want to hear my story. Wrong. My teachers do not care beans about my story. Yeah? They don't care at all about my childhood and what happened to me and in my school years and this and that and the other thing. They don't care. They want to know what is going on in your mind right now. Is it virtuous? Is it non-virtuous? If it's virtuous, good. If it's non-virtuous, do you know the antidotes to it? If you know them, apply them. If you don't know them, sit here and I'll explain them to you, and then you go and apply them. Yeah, my teacher wanted to know what's going on with you right now. Yeah. They're not therapists. Yeah. I wanted to tell my whole story. Da, da, da. Didn't care. And then, as one of the principal teachers I was studying with got busier and busier because he had a whole network of centers. And then, at the very beginning, it was just a few of us. And we could, sometimes get an appointment. But then once he became very well known, it's like so, difficult to get an appointment. That you know, that I had to seek other teachers who weren't as busy, and to talk with about different things, because you know, the teacher I started out with just was, he was unavailable. You know, he was traveling all over the world. So, yeah. So I'm not saying that your teachers are cold and they don't care about you. Okay. We tend to think if somebody doesn't want to hear my story, then they are not compassionate and they're cold and uncaring. Okay. So is there pervasion there? Those of you who've been studying Tibet. Yeah, does it pervade that if somebody doesn't want to hear your story, that means they don't care about you? That they're not compassionate? Well, I already told you the answer, but what do you really think? Oh, they're not listening to me. They don't have time for me. You know, I've offered so much service, and, you know, they don't have time to see me now. That always happens like this in my relationships. You know? Okay. So, we have to be very clear, you know, what the role of our spiritual mentor is. Yeah. And especially if you have a spiritual mentor from another culture. Americans, we talk about emotions right, left, and center. Yeah? Asians do not. In America, the way you become close to somebody is by sharing stories and telling each other about your emotions. In Tibet, at least, and I think in most of Asia, you become close to somebody by offering physical help, by helping them in some way. They have to move, they need somebody to prepare food. You do something, and that's how you become very good friends. And so in Asia, very good friends don't necessarily talk about all their feelings. Some people do, but it's not a given. Okay? So it's just something to be aware of so that we don't get disappointed. Okay? But our teachers very much care for us. Yeah? I mean, they want us to become Buddhas. They see potential in us that we don't even see in ourselves. The worldly people who care about us say, oh yeah, you have this problem, it's okay, that's too bad, we're sorry. Our spiritual teachers say, you have a problem, here's the antidote. You can overcome this. You can become a fully awakened Buddha. You don't have to sit there and whine because the world's unfair to you. Here's what you can do about it. So our teachers have enormous confidence in us. Yeah? And they care about us more than we care about ourselves, because we're satisfied to sit there and, you know, have a pity party. And they are not satisfied letting us sit there and have a pity party. Okay? So, you know, we have to revise our notion of what it means for somebody to care for us and what it means for us to care for somebody else. Because our usual notion is, you know, if I care for somebody and they care for me, they give me presents, they praise me, they do things for me, they tell me many times again and again how wonderful I am. They tell me many times again and again how much they love me. They send beautiful cards expressing wonderful loving sentiments to me. They remember my birthday. Yeah. They think that I'm, you know, the best disciple that could ever exist. And they cherish me. Yeah. And that's what we think, oh, that's, you know, what it means to have a good relationship. That's how our teachers are supposed to show how they care for us. And that's not exactly how it works. Okay? When we have a problem, yes, we can go to our teachers and ask for advice. Yeah. But when we do that, we have to remember that the teacher may have a lot of other people asking for their time. It's not like being in a family where you just have a brother and a sister to compete with for your parents' time. It, you know, your teachers have much more going on, okay? And to really know that the way our teachers care about us is by showing the confidence they have in our ability to grow and change and become Buddhas and progress along the path. Okay? So, you know, sometimes if our teacher points out our fault, we just like crumble, like, oh, they don't love me. And actually, we should say, oh, they love me a lot. Because who else is going to tell me this kind of stuff about myself so that I can grow up? Yeah, my friends, you know, don't hardly do that because I'd get mad at them. Yeah, somebody criticizes me. I'm like, who are you? Okay. But when our teachers point stuff out, it's because they care. Mm-hmm. Okay. So to really see the difference in the relationship, yeah. And to also remember, you know, a spiritual mentor is not like a therapist, yeah? You therapist you can call, I think, you know, whenever you have a really serious problem and, you know, they have a limited number of clients and you're paying them, so they will give you attention, but also because they care. But your student, your spiritual mentors may have many, many disciples and many things going on, and so they may not be able to sit with you throughout a whole big thing, okay? And instead, they give you some short advice, trusting us to put it into practice. Okay? So, and your teacher sometimes, our spiritual mentors can be quite strong with us, you know, when we are obnoxious, yeah, they can sometimes be very strong in pointing that out to us. But they do it because they care, not because they're trying to hurt us. Okay? So we have to be very clear about that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will tell you one story. So, before the Abbey began, I was, I had thought for many, many years to establish a monastery. I really wanted to do this. And I had started working with one other nun, you know, to try and do this. And then she got very seriously ill, and she couldn't do it anymore. And then I worked with, trying to think when this situation happened. Yeah, I think then I was working with one other monk and some other monks and nuns trying to start something. That didn't work out so well. So I got very upset inside and I was thinking, I want to know once and for all, should I try and make a monastery or should I just put that idea down and get on with my life? because I've been trying to do something and there's one obstacle after another. That my friend gets sick, she can't help, the other people, it doesn't work out with them. You know, well, I don't want to sit here and try and do something that's not going to go anywhere. If it's not going to go anywhere, because I want to do some other stuff. So, you know, I was very tight and upset about this, and I thought, I really have to go to my teacher and see him and say, please, you know, tell me once and for all, should I go ahead and do this, or should I just stop? I could not get an appointment to see my teacher. I asked, I could not get an appointment. I was so upset. I was living with some other nuns in, you know, and they knew how upset I was, and they were saying, you know, maybe you should do some practice to eliminate the obstacles so you can get an appointment, and, you know, say this mantra and that mantra, and and, you know, and they all, and then they were all going off on a picnic with some of my teachers, and I was just totally, like, crazy because I want to know once and for all what I should do, and I can't even get in to talk to my teacher. Yeah? And I could, that was it. I couldn't get an appointment. So this is how my teacher makes me grow up. Okay. It's like, okay, kiddo, think for yourself. Look at the circumstances. See what's possible. Yeah. He wasn't going to hold my hand through this whole thing and tell me what to do. So I used a few packages of these. You know, and then I got over it, and here we are. Okay, so that's just one kind of example. So, and the reason I tell you is in case you ever have something like that happen to you, you'll realize that you are not alone, and that your teachers are not picking on you, and they're not neglecting you, but this is how they help you grow up. I was thinking of all the different times when I really needed to talk to my teacher, and I could never get in at those times to talk to him. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, where were we? Complications arise if we have conscious or unconscious expectations that our spiritual mentors will meet our emotional needs, be our psychotherapist, tell us whom to marry, or choose our career. I was in Malaysia one time, and one woman came to see me. She said, I've been dating this one guy for a while. Should I marry him? What? You're asking me if you should marry somebody? You know, I didn't say that. And then she went on to explain, well, Lama so-and-so, when he was here, I asked him, and I said I should marry that man. And then Lama this and that came a few months afterwards, and I asked him, and he said, no, I shouldn't marry him. So now, please tell me what to do. You know, what am I supposed to say? I'm not going to tell her who to marry. You know, how in the world am I supposed to know who she should marry? Anyway, one time, one of my friends, some of you know Alex Berzin, he's a very good Buddhist teacher. So he went to ask one of our teachers, because Alex was living in Dharamsala. He had rented a little place where he lived for many years, and then there were problems with the landlord. So he went to our teacher and asked Circumuche, you know, what should I do? There's this problem with the landlord. And Rinpoche looked at him and said, go to a lawyer. How am I supposed to know how to solve your problem with the landlord? You know, ask somebody who knows that kind of stuff. I thought that was so cute. Okay, the role of spiritual mentors is to guide us in learning the Dharma, critically reflecting on its meaning, and correctly meditating on it. That's what the teacher is designed to help us do. This is why it is so important to be under their guidance. However, spiritual mentors do not do the work of getting realizations for us. We must practice the Dharma ourselves. So if we're quite upset and we're angry, we can ask our teacher, please teach me the antidotes to anger, but then we have to go to practice those. In brief, the differences in roles and expectations between a traditional Dharma teacher-disciple relationship and a contemporary secular teacher-student relationship are great. It is important for everyone to be aware of these as we navigate the uncharted waters of the Dharma as it flows to new countries and new cultures. Okay. Also, I was thinking, you know, the difference, because not only between a Dharma teacher and a secular teacher, but a Dharma teacher and a therapist, is the therapist is really committed to taking that person's side in the sense of that person who they're counseling is a really important individual. I'm not explaining this properly. When a therapist has to help somebody, they are geared towards helping that person navigate other aspects of their life that the therapist is not engaged in. You know, and so I can really understand why, you know, therapists don't socialize with their clients, you know, why they don't, and what else are part of the guidelines? You don't get personal, they don't cook you dinner, you don't go out to tea with them, you don't go and meet their relatives, or go to, you know, their family dinners. You just see that person individually alone and help them navigate the other relationships in their life. Yeah? Correct? A Dharma teacher's role is quite different because the Dharma teacher is taking care of a whole group of people. So they can't just focus on the needs of one person in that group. They have to focus on the dynamics between all the people in the group. Okay? So, you know, in a Dharma center, in a monastery, whoever the teacher is, has to take everybody's needs into consideration. Because all those people live, you know, interact with each other, and the teacher interacts with the student, you know. So in a therapeutic relationship, you know, it's a very one-on-one, and the therapist doesn't know all the other people in your life, yeah? And the therapist is just responsible to you. But with your Dharma teacher, they're responsible to all of the disciples, yeah? And they're responsible to keep harmony amongst, they're not responsible for the harmony, the students are, but they're responsible for helping, when there's difficulties, helping the students to learn how to be harmonious with each other. Okay. Is this making some sense to you? Yeah. So it's different kind, a different kind of relationship. Yeah. Yeah. So it's very easy with a Dharma teacher to compare yourself to other disciples. Well, you know, our teacher spent more time with so-and-so, and they don't spend so much time with me. Yeah. Or my teacher let so-and-so go to somewhere to do something, but they told me, you know, better I don't go. There's much more tendency to compare yourself to other students. With a therapist, you don't even know the other people who are going. Yeah? So, you know, there's no sibling rivalry in a therapeutic relationship. You get mama or papa all to yourself for that hour. Yeah? In a Dharma teacher relationship, that's not going to happen. You know, you'll get some attention when you need it, but it's not going to be, you know, okay, everybody else go away and so then you start, you know, why are they paying more attention? They answer that person's questions. They don't answer my questions. You know, so there's much more of that kind of stuff going on. Oh, the joys. I would see sometimes what went on around one of my teachers. Oh, my goodness. You know, you think teachers have it easy, that everybody's respectful and they're kind and they're considerate. Uh-oh. You know, it's like some of the rivalry that I saw around some of my teachers, that's what made me stay away, because I didn't even want to be part of that whole thing. Yeah. But those were the people that I think my teacher was really trying to help. And they needed help. They were a pretty wild bunch. So it's just different how teachers help people. Yeah, what they do. I was at, I attended one conference in Taiwan. This was many years ago. And at the end of the, you know, there was a whole conference, and then they took us on a tour. It was really nice. And then at the end, you know, there was a whole closing thing, and the master was there. And he had three of the monastics who I think were helping him the most, some of the foremost organizers for this whole thing. And they were up in the front of the room together with the master. And I remember he was looking, you know, okay, I don't remember about what he did with the first person, but then the second one was this nun. And this nun was so good, and she helped with this and that, and, you know, you should please give her a round of applause, because, you know, this whole area of the conference and the pilgrimage was really due to her energy, and you know, it's wonderful what she did, and I want to personally thank her. And so, of course, you know, she felt quite good. Then there was another monk at the end. And then the teacher said, but that monk, I gave him responsibility and he flaked out. You know, this is at the closing ceremony of a conference with several hundred people. And the master in front of everybody is going, you know, I asked him to help with many things, and he sometimes just didn't do it. It's kind of mediocre, and so I have to apologize, you know, to all of you who came for this conference for what happened with him. Yeah, you have good visualization of what that was like. And I remember thinking, that's the student that's very close to the teacher. Yeah. That's the student who the teacher knows is a really good disciple. because that the teacher knows that that monk could take it and that that monk would grow because of it. Yeah. So that made a very strong impression on me, you know, watching that happen. Because, the teacher, this was a very famous Taiwanese master, by the way. He wouldn't talk to just anybody that way. It had to be a disciple who was quite close. Okay, so then there's the reflections. Why is it important to have spiritual mentors? So this is something to think about. And second, how does the relationship with the spiritual mentor differ from one with a school teacher or professor? And we didn't put therapists in here, but we should have a question about how does it differ from a relationship with a therapist? And then next section, this section's very interesting. Yeah. It's called Three Types of Practice, Three Types of Spiritual Mentors. And this is something that His Holiness speaks of often, and not everybody is aware of this, okay? At least in Tibetan Buddhism. So Tibetan Buddhism includes three types of practice, each with its own emphasis, method of practice, and ethical restraints. Fundamental vehicle, perfection vehicle, and Vajra vehicle. Those are three types of vehicles. Now, in the fundamental vehicle, students learn the four truths of Aryas, commonly called the Four Noble Truths, but that's not a good translation. So the students learn the four truths of Aryas and come to seek liberation from cyclic existence. To bring this about, they take refuge in the three jewels and practice the three higher trainings of ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. In terms of ethical restraints, the students avoid the 10 non-virtues and take pratimoksha precepts as a lay or monastic follower of the Buddha. The lay precepts consist of the five precepts to abandon killing, stealing, unwise or unkind sexual behavior, lying, and taking intoxicants. The monastic precepts include those of novice and fully ordained monastics. Okay, so that's one vehicle, the fundamental vehicle. That's what you study, how you practice, the precepts, the ethical restraints you adopt, and so on. Then, on that basis of practicing the fundamental vehicle teachings, we go on to practice the perfection vehicle, or paramitayana, which is one branch of Mahayana. Okay. So here, students learn and meditate on the methods to cultivate bodhicitta, and come to seek full awakening in order to benefit others most effectively. To actualize this, they take the bodhisattva precepts and engage in practicing the six perfections of generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, and wisdom. Okay, that's the second vehicle. Third vehicle, the Vajra vehicle, is also a branch of the Mahayana, and thus the motivation to practice it is the same as with the perfection vehicle, the bodhicitta motivation to attain full awakening. Practitioners enter the Vajra vehicle because their compassion is exceptionally strong. They want to attain awakening quickly because they cannot endure sentient beings suffering. To accomplish this, they receive empowerment into the practice of a tantric deity and engage in the practice of deity yoga. All tantric practitioners adopt the bodhisattva ethical code, and those initiated into the yoga tantra and highest yoga tantra also adopt the tantric ethical code. Okay. So these three types of practice have three types of teachers. Okay, different kinds of teachers for each of those three practices. Many similarities exist in the qualifications of each type of teacher and the way students relate to them, but differences also exist. Fundamental vehicle, perfection vehicle, and Vajra vehicle texts reveal a progression in the way of regarding and relating to teachers, spiritual mentors. Okay. Our fundamental vehicle teacher instructs us in the four truths, gives us refuge and layer monastic precepts, and teaches us the Vinaya, the monastic discipline. As such, he or she acts as a representative of the Buddha. So this is how we see our fundamental vehicle teacher, who's teaching us the four truths, gives us monastic and lay precepts and refuge. Okay, we see that teacher as a representative of the Buddha. Okay, so we see our teacher as a teacher, our preceptor as a preceptor, and relate to him or her on a human level. We regard him or her as a wise elder, a sincere practitioner from whom we can learn. Okay. For monastics, three Vinaya teachers are especially important for their training. The first is their preceptor or abbess or abbot, okay, upajaya or upajaya, the person heading the sangha of monastics that ordains them. Okay. Second is the activity instructor, the karma acharya, who gives guidance and instruction during the ordination ceremony. This is for the full ordination ceremony. Third is the interview instructor, who privately interviews the candidate to see if obstacles to ordination exist. Another important teacher for a person practicing fundamental at the fundamental vehicle level is the resident teacher, the principal teacher of the monastery in which the monastic resides. So we may reside in the for a monastic in the same monastery as our teacher, or our teacher may send us to another monastery to stay. Okay, but the what is called in Tibetan the Neki Lama, the resident Lama at whatever monastery we live at, is a very important person. And even though our principal teacher may be somebody else, we should follow the instructions of the resident teacher at the monastery where we live, if it's different than our preceptor. Vinaya puts great importance on the resident teacher because that is the person who trains the junior monastics on a daily basis. Okay? Because sometimes what happens is you go to an ordination ceremony and they'll ask the very highly recognized and capable teachers to be the ones who give the ordination. But after the ordination, you go back to your own monastery and you live there. And so with your own teacher, and your own teacher is the one who trains you on a daily basis. So that person's quite important. You can't go back to your own monastery and say, but, you know, my preceptor said we should get up at 6 o'clock, and you say we should get up at 5 o'clock, and I want to do what my preceptor says. Okay? So, you know, if you're a monastic, wherever you live, even if you're visiting, you go along with the way things are done at that place. Okay? So the perfection vehicle texts speak of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas emanating in many forms to benefit others. Since our perfection vehicle teacher leads us on the Bodhisattva path and gives us the Bodhisattva ethical restraints, we view that person as an emanation of the Buddha or emanation of the Buddha or of a high bodhisattva. Okay? So our Vinaya teacher, we see as a representative of the Buddha. We relate to them as a one human being to another, you know? According to their role. We relate to our preceptors as our preceptor, our resident teacher as our resident teacher, and so on. In the perfection vehicle, okay, because this practice really talks about bodhisattvas and Buddhas emanating all over the universe, and the teacher who gives us the bodhisattva ethical restraints, who teaches us the six perfections and so on, with that person we see as an emanation of the Buddha or as a high bodhisattva. Okay. Here the teacher is seen as equal to or like, similar to a Buddha. Not the Buddha, but similar to a Buddha, in the sense that the karma accumulated in relation to our teacher is similar to that accumulated in relation to the Buddha, because our teacher is teaching us the bodhisattva vehicle, just as the Buddha would do that. By making offerings to or harming our perfection vehicle teacher, we accumulate karma equal to acting in a similar way towards the Buddha himself. When we have trained in the fundamental vehicle and the perfection vehicle practices and are sufficiently mature in the Dharma, we may request empowerment into practices of various tantric meditational deities. Okay. So one big conception, a misconception in the West is that Tantrayana or Vajrayana is a totally different kind of practice than the other ones, but here you see very clearly it's done on the basis of the fundamental vehicle teachings and the perfection vehicle teachings. Okay, so somebody has to be very well trained in those two initial vehicles before entering Vajrayana. That's theoretically. Nowadays, it can be quite different. Okay. So students imagine the guru giving the empowerment, the tantric empowerment, to be the meditational deity and the environment to be the deity's abode or mandala. When doing tantric practice following empowerment, we imagine ourselves and all sentient beings as Buddhas and the environment as a pure land. In this case, not seeing our tantric master as a Buddha would be very strange. Okay, so we see the environment as a pure land, sentient beings as Buddhas. Of course, we should see our tantric master, who's the one who teaches us all this, as a Buddha. Okay, only in tantric practice is it essential to regard the tantric master as a Buddha. This view should not be taught to beginners who are not mature in the Dharma, because it is open to misinterpretation and confusion. So one of the big problems in Tibetan Buddhism now is that this teaching is taught very widely because people are given tantric initiation often quite early on, before they've actually before they're really grounded in the four truths of the Aryas that the fundamental vehicle teacher has taught them, before they're well grounded in bodhicitta and the six perfections that their perfection vehicle teacher has taught them. Some people just, you know, take tantric initiations, and they're very easily, you know, kind of they're given in different Dharma centers, okay? So this is something that has creates some problem, because then people are taught right away, well, if you're practicing Tantra, since you're supposed to be seeing everybody as the Buddha, then you better see your teacher as the Buddha too, and relate to your teacher like you're relating to the Buddha, okay? And then people you know, talk about projection. Well, if my, you know, Westerners take this very literally. Yeah, I think Tibetans see it more as a practice that helps us grow in the Dharma, but Westerners take it very literally. This teacher is a Buddha. Therefore, he should know what I should do about my problem with the landlord. Because if he's a Buddha, he's omniscient. So I should be able to go and ask him about the problem with the landlord. I should be able to go and ask him what medicine to take for my disease. He should know how to get from here to the Spokane airport, even though he's never been in the area before, because he's omniscient. Okay? So Westerns take this very literally, and then they start thinking like this. And then also in the scriptures, very often they're told that, you know, everything your guru does is perfect. And then, you know, and then because the people are not grounded in the Dharma and they took tantric initiation very early, well, everything my guru does is perfect, but my guru burps and farts. What's going on here? How am I supposed to have, pure view and see this person as a Buddha if he burps and farts? This is just not acceptable, you know. And how do I see, you know, this person as a Buddha if he thinks George W. was an excellent president? Yeah. And how do I think this teacher is a Buddha, you know, if he treats women, you know, the nuns, in a different way than he treats the monks? And then, you know, we get very, very confused. Okay. So we have to, this is why His Holiness says, you know, only in tantric practice is it essential to regard the tantric master as the Buddha. You don't regard your fundamental vehicle master as a teacher, as a Buddha. You don't regard your perfection vehicle teacher as the Buddha. It's essential to do that only for your tantric teacher. But nowadays, it's very often taught, because people enter tantra so soon, it just says, see your guru as the Buddha. And then, you know, people took refuge in the five precepts with, you know, just some, you know, one monk or one nun. And then they go, oh my God, I have to see that person's the Buddha, you know. And then they get really, really confused. Okay? So His Holiness says, I recommend going about the stages of practice in a gradual way. Oh, and he said before that, okay, this view of the guru as the Buddha, you know, applies only to the tantric guru, and it should not be taught to beginners who are not mature in the Dharma, because it is open to misinterpretation and confusion. Okay. So I recommend going about the stages of practice in a gradual way. First, form a relationship with a fundamental vehicle teacher. Learn the four truths, true dukkha, true causes of dukkha, the cessation, the path, the true path. Okay. Learn those. Take refuge and take some level of the Pratimoksha precepts, either the five lay precepts, monastic ordination, something that helps us get our ethical conduct in order. Later, as your practice progresses, seek out a spiritual mentor who can teach you the bodhisattva path, and then practice the six perfections and undertake the bodhisattva ethical restraints. After some more time, when you're properly prepared, seek a qualified, again this word, qualified tantric master. Receive empowerment into that practice of a specific meditational deity and meditate on deity yoga. Okay. Shakbar Tsokdruk Rangdrol, the great Tibetan yogi who did extensive retreat and was a prolific writer, speaks of these three kinds of teachers. Okay. So this is what Shakbar Tsokdruk Rangdrol said. From the teacher who showed the path of deliverance or liberation, yeah, I received the sacred teachings of individual liberation, meaning the Vinaya teachings, the Pratimoksha precepts. My practice was to shun wrongdoing and cultivate virtue. From the Bodhisattva teacher, I received the sacred Mahayana teachings on generating bodhicitta. My practice was to cherish others more than myself. From the Vajradhara teacher, I received the sacred teachings, empowerments, and instructions of the secret mantrayana. My practice was to meditate upon the generation and completion states and Dzogchen. Okay, so that Tibetan master spelled it out very clearly in that way. You know, what the teacher it is, what you receive from that teacher, and what your main practice is. Okay, and so you can see that it's a gradual development. You know, as you develop as a disciple, then the kinds of teachers that you seek instruction from, that's going to develop as well. There's a beautiful story in the Flower Ornament Sutra about one disciple, Sudana, and he wanted to attain full awakening. And he went to 53 teachers, seeking instruction. So the first teacher he learned one thing with, then that teacher sent him into another one, and there he learned something else. And then that teacher sent him to another one, and he learned something else. And so he had reverence for all 53 of his teachers because they all played an important part in his gaining all the understandings and realizations of the Bodhisattva path. Let's just pause here. Do people have questions so far?
So for me, it's not quite clear when you say on the perfection vehicle that the teacher is seen as an emanation of Buddha or Bodhisattva, so how that is different to the Vajra vehicle.
Vajra vehicle, you see them as the Buddha.
What's different than seeing in somebody as an emanation?
An emanation? The Buddha is the Buddha. An emanation is coming out of the Buddha.
A related question. So does that mean that we see our Vajrayana teacher as a Buddha when he's given us the empowerment or forever thereafter?
Ah, very good question. I think my understanding from an example His Holiness gave, which is in the book, is you see your Vajrayana guru as a teacher definitely when they're giving empowerment, definitely when they're teaching the practice. Okay. In His Holiness's case, he also had his teachers were also the regents of the Tibetan government when he was a minor. So he also had to relate to his teachers in an administrative political situation. Okay. And in that situation, he related to them in a very, very different way. Okay? Let me think of some other examples. I remember listening to a talk by Samdong Rinpoche once. He was the prime minister of Tibet for many, many years, of the Tibetan government in exile. And he's really wonderful. And he and His Holiness are like, they're very, very close. And being the prime minister of the Tibetan government in exile, he had to confer with His Holiness. This was before His Holiness retired from you know, being in the Tibetan government in exile. Samdang Rinpoche said, you know, I expressed my opinion to his holiness. If I agree with his ideas, I tell him why. If I don't agree with his ideas, I respectfully explain why I don't think those are good ideas. I present my own ideas. I present the reasons why I think, you know, this kind of policy would work well. So he you know, related to his holiness as a prime minister would relate to the, you know, the big person in charge. Okay, he did it very respectfully. It's not like what's going on in Washington, D.C. Yeah, but he, you know, he expressed his ideas. He dialogued about it. He told His Holiness when he disagreed. Okay, so I think, you know, we have to relate to our teachers different in different situations. Yeah, when they're teaching us the Dharma, you know, we need to listen and be receptive to what they're telling us and then put it into practice. When we're working together with the teacher to, you know, plan a septic system or figure out what kind of Buddha statue we want, or you're designing the Buddha hall, you have to relate in a totally different way. You don't just sit there and go, yes, 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 because the teacher isn't necessarily an expert in that thing. And if you know more, you have to give your ideas. Okay, otherwise it can be really damaging. What did they do? They told Trump, who was it who told Trump? Kelly told him, you know, don't be surrounded by just yes people. Because if all you're doing is you're surrounded by people who just go yes, 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 he said you'll get impeached. But, you know, yeah, he said that to Trump. But, I mean, the point is you need people who know when you are in a position of responsibility like that. You need people who are experts in many different fields to give you advice, and you need to listen to them because you don't know beans, okay? So in that kind of situation, to say, well, my teacher's omniscient, so, you know, they can figure out how to get the septic permit and the building permit and you know, how to design the statue and what material the statue should be made out of and how to get, you know, daylight into the hall and how to do this and that, and, you know. And they can just, they're omniscient, they can figure the whole thing out. And then your teacher says, oh, let's put the septic system over there. And the area is all full of rocks. And you know you can't put a septic system there. What do you do? Do you go, oh, yes, yes, Master, I agree with you? Yeah? If you do that, I mean, that's stupid, isn't it? You have to respectfully say, well, actually, it's not so good to put septic systems where there's a lot of rocks, because then the stuff, it doesn't perk well, and it has to perk. You know how septic systems work, and they need to perk, okay? So, you know, you need to explain that, and so, okay, that area is not so good. There's too, you know, there's all there are big boulders. There's no dirt there. You know, we can't put the septic system there. Here's a better place, okay? You have to say that. Yeah? Otherwise, and that's not being disrespectful. You know, if you go in there and you say to the teacher, you dimwit, don't you know you can't build a septic system where there's boulders? That's not so cool, okay? You don't talk to your teacher that way. Actually, you shouldn't talk to any living being that way, okay? Especially your teacher. But if the teacher doesn't know and you have more information, then you need to explain it, yeah? And your teacher may have a different idea, and you may need to dialogue about it. And that's fine. You do it in a respectful way. But if I just said, you know, oh, Venerable Simke, with the forest, you know, we have so much debris. Just, you know, they say now, burn all the debris. Burn it early so the whole forest doesn't catch on fire. So let's go down there tomorrow morning and we'll just burn everything on the hillside. And it'll, you know, it'll get rid of all that dead stuff. Yeah. And Venerable Simke is going to look at me and go, are you kidding? You know, the trees are too close together. You can't do that. There's no way to put out a fire if it gets out of hand there. You know, especially if I say that to her in the middle of the summer when it's, you know, 90 degrees and everything's dry. You know, what's she going to do? I'll say, oh, yes, yes, of course. You know, give me the matches. I'll go light the fire. Okay, so, you know, we are respectful, but we have to, you know, dialogue about these things, okay? That answers your question, okay? Yeah. You had a question? Okay.
So the other day at lunch, I was sitting next to you, and then during the chanting, and the prayers, you looked at my legs and they were like stretched out, you know, and crossed at the ankles, and you said, sit up straight during the prayers. And so I straightened up and there was a guest at the table and she gave me this look like, oh, I can't believe she just said that to you. You must be in such pain. Like that was a look on her face. So I was like, oh, you know, okay, how am I going to think about this situation? And I said, she cares about me. You know, she wants me to be proper, a proper nun. So
yeah.
I was able, although I did get a little twinge of like, oh, criticism. But the contrast with her face, it just, yeah. I thought it was so funny.
She's probably going, oh, I'm going to stay away from this teacher. Told me to sit up straight. My mother told me to sit up straight. I'm done with that. You know? Yeah. Yesterday, if you feel sorry for yourself, yesterday I pushed the person in front of me in the chanting because there was too wide of a gap between them and the next person. Just pushed them. I didn't go wham! Yeah, did I? I just pushed. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And you kept a reasonable distance after that. Yeah. And did anybody see that and go, oh. Oh, I'm so glad it was her and not me. Okay, yeah.
The first few years, the number of years I lived here, I had a lot of jealousy going when I perceived my teacher treating people special. But as the community has grown, I've really trained my mind to say, anytime my teacher teaches, she's giving me personal instruction. And that took so much of the jealous mind away. And more often than not only when my teacher's teaching in a big venue, but if I see anything that she's giving feedback or directions or just suggestion to somebody else, and I hear that, I say, that's for you too. And I have learned more about my mind looking at the teachings as personal instructions rather than waiting for that stellar moment where I can have a one-on-one, because that just can't happen, you know, as much as it used to. But that's been a very important teaching for
yeah.
me.
Because if you have that attitude, then whenever your teacher gives instructions to other people, you get a lot of teachings. Yeah. But if you view that as, oh, they're paying more attention to somebody else and ignoring me. But then when they pay attention to you and they tell you to sit up straight, it's like, oh, get away. You know?
Bit of a change of topic, but going back to what you first mentioned this morning about how we don't it's only conceptual minds that create virtue. So then there's the teaching that just by seeing holy objects, it creates causes for us to, like, it results in happiness in the future. So how does that work?
Go ask a Buddha. How does it work? I think it works the same way as when you're in a movie theater and they flash a thing of Coke so quickly that you don't realize it, but then you get up and go buy a Coke. I think that's how it works. You know, it stimulates something in the mind. You know, your visual consciousness catches it, but it's the mental consciousness, you know. Yeah, I mean, you're not even ascertaining that, but, you know, in the theater, but it's having an effect on your mind. Yeah. Or if you're the fly going around the stupa, being in the close proximity to, you know, something like that. Because, I mean, what we see influences us. Yeah. If you went someplace and you saw Rambo, you know, is your mind going to be virtuous after seeing Rambo? Rambo's too old. People don't know who he is. Okay. Who is it? Spider-Man. Okay. We got to go back to Spider-Man. Okay. So when you see Spider-Man, you know, is your mind going to be virtuous after that? Just looking at Spider-Man? Yeah. If you haven't seen Spider-Man, fly on United Airlines. He's the one that does all their, tells you, you know, to use your mask and to all that kind of stuff. But he's zipping around, flying here and there and tying people up, and people are like going like this. It's really, I don't know how United Airlines did that. But anyway, you know, it affects your mind. If you see, if you come in here and you see the Buddha and he's just sitting there so quietly and peacefully, that affects your mind. So it's like that. So this will be the last question.
I had a question back on page 78 with the passage about spiritual companionship being the entire path, the entire practice. Does that refer to just our formal teacher who's in that role, or also to like a monastic who we seek advice from or have Dharma conversations with?
It's referring to the Buddha.
Just to the Buddha.
That's how I see it. You know, and then our Dharma teachers they're teaching us just like the Buddha would teach us. So in that way, you know, we can take it from the Buddha and see, you know, see the relationship with our own teachers as if we were being taught by the Buddha, because the Buddha's no longer here. Yeah. So it was, you know, of course we can learn from anybody, can't we? Yeah. Doesn't have to be a monastic, doesn't even have to be a Buddhist, you know. You can look at the bugs and learn. Okay, so, but that quotation was really, I think, emphasizing the importance of following the Buddha's teachings.
Not just anyone who has a positive effect on our spiritual practice, but specifically the Buddha.
Yeah, that's how I interpret the passage. Okay, but like I said, lots of people can have a positive effect on our practice. And of course, we, you know, should feel grateful to them for, you know, whatever positive effect they've had on us.